Chapter 8. Conjunction. Dead space. The visible universe was a weathered brown blackness, as if the void was somehow filled with a fog of dirty starlight. Nebulous beige streamers of some exotic matter streaked the depths. More than anything else, there was distance, the unfathomable distance of gazing out from the bounds of a harsh and inhospitable solar system, a few lonely rocks tumbling around a dull, grinding, electromagnetic light source into the humiliating immensity of the interstellar gulf. Then, lightning struck. The lightning was a spear 1,000 kilometres long. At the heart of its blinding shock light was a twisting vein of toxic yellow, like scorched ceramic. At its origin point, an interspatial bubble of rupturing subatomics, the root of the lightning was brighter than any star and shot through with threads of sour green and galvanic blue. The lightning flashed and died. Then another spear flashed, and then a third that was twice as long as the first two. It scored a line of light across the dark firmament and left a fading afterimage like a jagged fault line. A fourth flash followed, this one finally puncturing real space and eating a hole through it, like a hungry flame burning through a sheet of paper. Suffixed by a halo of aftershock lightning, the Highness Sir Armaduke translated through the puncture, leaving the warp behind and coasting slowly out into the materium. Etheric energies coursed off its flanks like thawing ice, shredding away in its wake and disintegrating. The translation point behind it popped and crackled as it healed and faded, puffing and cracking like a membrane under pulses of thumping pressure. The Armaduke stabilised and adjusted its real space passage. Its auspecs and detector grids began to pattern search and composite the visible star fields to verify the navigation plot. Vox systems were enabled. 6 minutes after achieving translation, a deck officer brought a data slate to Shipmaster Spiker. Spiker adjusted his silver-plated voice horn on its stalk. "Translation complete," he announced, his voice ringing through the ship. Tavis Sun, approach now factoring for fleet conjunction." He turned off the speaker and looked at his deck officer.
"Have we detected the elements?"
"Not yet, sir," said the officer.
"If they have made the schedule, we expect to track them in the next 20 minutes.
"Has engineering come back on that consultation I requested?" Spiker asked. Since that first anomalous tremble hours before, he had been attempting to trace the aberration.
"I understand a full field and rate diagnostic is on its way up," said the officer.
"Hurry them, please," said Spiker. A klaxon sounded.
"Battle fleet elements detected,"
another officer called out. "Holding position around the local star, close and preparing for Vauxhall." They were back in real space. Corin could feel it. He had attempted to slip up deck towards the main Vauxcaster assembly, but it was proving too difficult. There was too much activity, too many people who would see him and question his business in a crew section. He wouldn't be able to stay in the Vaux room long enough to achieve his goals. Instead, ever pragmatic, he headed back down towards the old munitions magazine that was serving as a cell. From his observations, the guard detail would be approaching a shift change. The men would be tired. And there were only two of them at the hatch. A full interdiction flotilla was waiting for the Armaduke. It was a patrol group from Battlefleet Culan. 4 frigates and 2 cruisers supported the aggressor Libertus, an Exorcist-class grand cruiser, and the Sepiterna, an Oberon-class battleship. In their train was a family of bulk transports and fleet tenders. As soon as they identified the Armaduke, making its long, curve approach in from the system rim along the invariable plane, a barrage of Vauxhalls went up. Several squadrons of fighters were launched from the flight decks of the capital ships, and one of the escort frigates, the Benedicamus Domino, impelled forwards, void shields up, to meet the approaching vessel while its identity was confirmed. Tavis Sun glowered behind the fleet spread, a malevolent red coal. The immense ships were just blowfly dots against its hot, dark mass. It was an old star, roomy and frail, bloated and throbbing with wheezing electromagnetic gasps, like a feast-day fire dying in its grate at the end of the night. Its rasping, radiostatic voice blurred and chopped the Vox transmissions, sandpapering the communication links. The star was bleeding cold gas and hot radiation into its lifeless system as it used up the last few millennia of its fuel mass. Dark spots like tumours appeared in its flushed coronosphere. Occasional septic pulses of energy and flame flared out into its stellar shadow. The planetary bodies that orbited it were scorched dead rocks or rings of debris, the residue of the ferocious burn the star had suffered a million years earlier at the start of its terminal decline. The Highness Sir Armaduke gunned in, riding the gravitic slope, 20 million kilometres out and closing. Its flight decks and excursion bays began to prepare for open cycle. Tender boats and suppliers scooted forwards from the fleet line and fell in behind the Benedicamus Domino. At the master station, Spica took the report from his deck officer. "Incoming hail from Craigo, master of the fleet," said a Vox herald. "One moment," said Spica, reading, speeding his way through the data slate. "What is it, sir?" asked the deck officer. "Fleet Master Craigo is hailing again," called the herald. Look at this," said Spica. The deck officer peered at the hololithic displays Spica was consulting. They were field effect summaries from the Emeterium leg. The deck officer had seen similar profile reports 1,000 times. "What am I looking at?" he asked. "Fleet Master Craigo is hailing again," called the herald. "Wait," Spica growled. "Look here. You see?" "I see a Geller field profile," said the deck officer. "Nothing untoward," Spica agreed. "Until you see how it compares to the one at the previous interval, and the one at the interval that followed." "I still don't see, sir. The Geller field was altering during transit. Its configuration was changing." "Within tolerances," said the deck officer. "Isn't that normal fluctuation?" "It repeats," said Spica, his voice tight and unhappy. "It repeats, you see. There is a pattern to it. But you only see it when you run the sampled profiles one after another. That's not normal field variance. That's an artificial repetition."
"Artificial, sir?" asked the deck officer.
Along the deck frame of the launch platform, hazard lamps were cycling and the chamber was shuddering with the din of airgate alarms. A massive overhead clamp had just positioned the elegant blue and white Aquila lander on the blast deck, and servitor teams were detaching the cradle lines and feeders with power tools. Gaunt walked with Lord Militant Cybon towards the boarding ramp. Over their heads, a series of hard metal thumps accompanied the retracting hoist, and the thick delivery hatch that led up into the Armaduke starboard small ship hangar rumbled shut. Staff aides hurried past them, carrying the Lord Militant's luggage. A duty officer approached and saluted.
"Transfer standing by, sir," he said.
Cybon acknowledged him with a slight nod.
"The Sepiturna awaits," said Gaunt.
The war master," replied Cybon. "I should be with them in 18 weeks, in time enough to communicate the essence of this plan in person, and in time to consider its success."
"Or otherwise," said Gaunt.
Cybon studied him. The Lord Militant's eyes seemed very old, as though they had seen too much. Gaunt's, by comparison, were very new for precisely the same reason.
"I never took you to be a pessimist, Gaunt," rumbled Cybon.
"I'm not, sir," Gaunt replied. "Just a pragmatist."
"The Emperor protects," said Cybon.
"That's just what I tell the men," said Gaunt.
"And if he doesn't protect you, you don't need protecting," Cybon added.
I'm not sure if that's entirely reassuring, said Gaunt.
It's not supposed to be, said Cybone. Do I look like a sentimental old bastard to you? I'm simply passing on what experience has shown me.
He turned to board the lander. Gaunt could feel the air pressure in the bay begin to change as the air gate began to cycle to release. Safe voyage, said Gaunt. He regretted it instantly. Sentiment didn't sit well with either of them. Cybone snorted derisively. Halfway up the ramp, he turned to look back at Gaunt. He made the sign of the Aquila, nodded, and disappeared into the shuttle.
Clear the deck space, shouted the launch officer. Clear the deck space.
The Armajuk continued to decelerate towards the ships sent out to greet it. They were entering the close approach phase, with the battle fleet's fighter screen spreading out wide around the newcomer. A small speck, bright and fast-moving, left the starboard flank of the coasting Armajuk like a launched flare and began to accelerate away towards the main fleet grouping. From an observation bay, Gaunt watched the Aquila on its way. He turned, descended on the steps and pushed through the busy deck crews and launch personnel to reach the nearest access hallway. He met Hark and Kolea coming the other way. They didn't have to say anything for him to know they were looking for him, and the news was going to be bad.
"Edder's dead," said Hark.
"How?" Gaunt asked, immediately imagining some shipboard accident.
"A maintenance crew found his body at the bottom of an inspection hatch 15 minutes ago," said Kolea. "Injuries consistent with a fall."
"A fall?" asked Gaunt.
"The sort of fall you might have if you'd already been beaten to death," said Kolea.
"Throne,"
Gaunt murmured.
"Victor, mobilise the regiment. We're going to find the killer immediately. I'll go directly to the shipmaster and inform him of the situation. We're going to need the cooperation of him and his crew if we're going to section the ship."
He looked at Kolea.
"Gol, get to Rowan, fast as you can. Tell him security has been compromised."
Rowan approached the armoured hatchway of the magazine-turned cell. Kant and McTally were waiting for him.
"Open it," Rowan said. "You're not due for another 2 hours," Kant began.
"There's a problem. Open it." Kant turned to bang on the outer hatch. McTally hoisted his las rifle and covered the approach hall. Coming in right behind Kant, Rowan already had his straight silver drawn in his right hand, the blade up his sleeve. His left hand deftly slipped the loop out of his hip pocket.
"Where's your badge, sir?" asked McTally.
"What?" asked Rowan.
"Your badge. You said we should all wear them."
Without hesitation, Rowan threw the knife. He delivered the straight silver with a vicious and expert underhand throw, and the blade buried itself in McTally's heart. He fell back against the corridor wall and slid down, instantly dead. Before he'd even begun to topple, Rowan had hooked the loop over Kant's head from behind. It was a steel string from a colours band lyre. Kant had barely time to notice it was there when Rowan twisted the loop to tighten it. The string cut into his neck like a cheese wire. Kant toppled backwards into Rowan, blood pouring from an almost 360-degree throat wound, his mouth wide open, unable to breathe or cry out. Rowan let Kant go. The trooper's legs were still twitching. There was a considerable pool of blood. Rowan drew his las pistol. He took one last look at Kant's beached fish expression and rearranged his own features. There was a hideous and painful scrunch of bone and muscle, and a second Kant faced the entrance. He banged in the door, then opened the outer hatch.
"Coming in, one visitor,"
he said over his microbead.
"Read that."
The peephole slot in the inner door opened, and Kant stood where the guard inside could clearly see the face he had made for the occasion. The inner hatch began to unbolt.
"What's the matter with you, Kant?" said Cabri, looking out at him. "You're supposed to stay outside."
Kant shot him in the face and kicked the hatch wide open.
"Fleetmaster Craigo demands that you issue a full response, sir,"
the Vox Herald pleaded.
"Shut that man up," Spiker snapped to his number one. "I'm trying to think."
There was a commotion behind him. He glanced around to see the guard commander, gaunt, pushing his way onto the master station platform, ignoring the attempts of the deck officers to head him off.
"Shipmaster Spiker has no time to deal with you now,"
one of the officers was repeating in a whining tone. Gaunt punched him in the mouth and laid him out on the deck.
"Sorry,"
he told the man in what seemed like a genuine tone of remorse. He reached Spiker's side.
"We've got a serious problem."
"How do you know about the Gellerfield?" asked the shipmaster.
"I..." Gaunt began. "What about the Gellerfield? I'm talking about a security breach, a killing."
Spiker blinked slowly.
So they know we're here," he said quietly.
"It's what?" asked Gaunt. "What is?"
"It's so they know we're here. It's a trail they can track."
Spiker's pitch was rising.
"Oh, holy throne of terror!"
He wrenched his silver-plated voice horn up close to his mouth.
"Alert! Alert station! Shields up! Shields up! Shields up!"
The bridge personnel turned from their positions and stared at him. They were young, painfully inexperienced. A few of them clearly thought it was a surprise drill.
"Don't gawp at me, you mindless idiots! Do it now!"
Spiker yelled. Multiple alarms and bells began to sound. The bridge crew went into a kind of overdrive, dashing in all directions. Light levels dipped as the shields woke up. Squealing and clattering, ceramite shutters began to close like eyelids across the real space ports.
"Are we under attack?" asked Gaunt.
"I think the prospects are very likely," replied Spiker.
"Lord Militant Cybon is out there, in a small unescorted ship," said Gaunt.
Spiker ran his tongue around the inside of his lips as he thought about this.
"Damn him,"
he said. He looked at the officer of detection, whose seat was surrounded by dead-eyed auxiliary servitors, spinally hard-wired into the deck.
"Full sensory sweep," Spiker said. "Locate the Lord Militant's ship, track it, and prepare to put us between it and any attack if necessary."
A different series of alarms sounded.
"Contact, contact," the officer of detection announced. "Translation signature, 3 AU to port." "A ship! Identify!"
yelled Spiker.
"Tracking one signature. Tracking a second signature. Tracking a third. 3,
asked Spiker.
"Tracking a fourth."
Lightning struck. The lightning was a spear 1,000 kilometres long. This time, it was red, like the most malignant hatred, and shot through with snakes of yellow and coral pink. The lightning flashed, puncturing real space and eating a hole through it, like acid eating through a plate of steel. Surrounded by a crown of thorns of aftershock lightning, 4 starships translated through the corroded wound, ploughing into the materium like missiles fired from a launcher. The first 2 were destroyer-class escorts, the 3rd, close behind them, was a much larger cruiser. The 4th, trailing slower and more ponderously still, was a monster, a vast battleship. All 4 vessels were blackened, as if they had spent too long scorching in the heart of a sun's furnace. A volcanic red light lit them from within, glaring from their window ports and coiling across their surfaces like veins filled with magma. They had once been Imperial ships, all of them of the most ancient patterns and design. But that identity and those lives led in Imperial service were distant memories. Gross corruption had stolen them from the Imperial fold eons before and transformed their adamantine carcasses to the whim of the ruinous powers. The ships began to scream. Hellish noises and fetid transmissions blasted out through their vox networks, as though each one possessed a voice, part animal howl, part augmetic rasp. On the Imperial ships, vox heralds collapsed at their consoles, their brains bursting as the amplified shrieks burned through their systems and shorted them out. Each arch-enemy ship howled out its name as it gunned in, gut howls that came from their inner cores, from the smoking hearts of their reactors. It was like the bellowing of mindless, stampeding cattle or the idiot shouting of lobotomized bulk servitors that knew nothing but their own names.
Ominator! Ominator! Raged the first destroyer. Go ahead!
Spat the shredded voxcasters of its twin.
Go ahead! Go ahead! Necrosta Antivassal!
Declared the blood-shot cruiser. Last of all, deepest and most awful, the voice of the monstrous capital ship, like the death scream of a black hole.
Domageddon Monster!